couple of other things in the notes from last week, but you probably won't even need to look at them because I can do them rather quickly. So starting then with the one page, the overall issue in the chapter is how are we to account for philosophic views that are other than our own? And how are we to do so in a way that acknowledges the potential contributions of others, even of those with whom we may disagree on important issues? Remember what Lonergan says, that any philosophic position is capable of making a contribution to a clarification of the basic issue of the polymorphic consciousness of human beings, any philosophy. So how can we acknowledge those potential contributions, even when we may disagree on important issues with the positions of another philosopher? And how can we do this in a way that acknowledges that all positions, our own included, will be limited and must be gone beyond? And how can we do that without falling into a relativism? So it's a big issue. It's the issue of interpretation. And it's the issue of whether any truth is possible in interpretation. And that's what we will be taking today, the truths of interpretation. The basic elements of an answer to those questions are presented in this chapter. At least that's his intention. And his basic statement is that any philosophy, whether actual or possible, will rest upon the dynamic structure of cognitional activity, either as correctly conceived or as distorted by oversights and by mistaken orientations, because every philosophy, actual or possible, is going to emerge from that structure. It's going to emerge from a subject, a philosophic subject, who is more or less attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. It's in terms of that dynamic structure that the potential contributions and the limitations of every philosophy can be discerned. We'll see that in greater detail today. Clearly, this basic statement will be expanded in Lonergan's later work to include not a three-level, but a six-level structure. So it will not only be in terms of the understanding of experience, understanding, and judgment, but also of what's prior to waking experience, namely the whole dimension of the dreaming consciousness, which is something that he brings explicitly into his sixfold structure in a late paper, Philosophy of the Religious Phenomenon. And then he adds a fourth level of waking consciousness, which begins to emerge in insight, but not yet as a distinct fourth level. And then he speaks about the fifth level of being in love. So there are really six if you take dreaming at the bottom and then you go through waking experience and understanding and judgment and decision and love. So it will be in terms of a six-level structure finally. But the basic position will survive, namely, to the extent that one appropriates this structure, it is to that extent that one will be equipped when presented with the relevant material to understand the utterances of others, whether these be philosophers or not. That's his basic point, and we'll see more of that today. To the extent that one has appropriated the structure, the dynamic structure of one's own intentional consciousness, to that extent one has the basic equipment needed to understand the utterances of other people. And particularly in this chapter, he's concerned with the philosophic utterances, but also others as well. And the first attempt at demonstrating the efficacy of his theorem is not with regard to philosophy, but rather with pre-philosophic expressions, symbol, story, song. I could have put that in there. Song, narrative, poetry, dream, myth. These are expressions that reflect and involve not only the intellectual operator or the spiritual operator, the pure desire for being, for the good, the transcendent, but also the psychic operator. A psychic operator that has a certain correspondence to this pure desire. These expressions, symbol, narrative, poetry, story, song, dream, myth, they come from this psychic operator. But that psychic operator has a correspondence to the pure desire. They come from some cosmic dimension, from some intimation of unplumbed depths that accrues to our feelings, our emotions, our sentiments. And the basic question of that section on mystery and myth has to do with how do we adjudicate those expressions? How do we sort them out? How do we distinguish symbolic or imaginal expressions of counterpositions from symbolic or imaginal expressions of positions? And he makes several contributions toward answering that question. It becomes extremely relevant, for instance, though in my experience, it was with a long attempt at not only understanding the texts of Jung, but actually trying to follow Jung through the psyche and finding at some point that there was a need for some kind of principle of adjudication. Because as I've tried to make very clear in some of my own work, I can go a long way with somebody like Jung, but there comes a certain point where there's another orientation that has been built into me in terms of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius and in terms of the Christian tradition, where at some point I have to say, it stops here. There's something he's leading into an area that there's got to be another way through than the one that he's suggesting. And that's in terms of the whole matter of the integration of good and evil, placing evil in God, and so on, which are positions that I simply could not identify with or accept. All right, how do you adjudicate? These are all coming from out of the symbolic expression and the interpretation of symbolic expressions. What Jung is doing with a lot of his stuff is interpreting symbolic texts, interpreting religious texts, interpreting dreams, and so on, and he's ending up at a certain point where he gets you to a certain point where some of us have to say, no, we can't go that way. We have to find some other way of dealing with the types of expressions that he's talking about. All right, what's the criterion for that? All right, Lonergan makes at least the following contributions to answering those questions. First, symbolic presentations and their associated feelings and emotions are not in themselves invested with explanatory power. They're not explanations of anything. They're expressions, but they're not explanations. They are expressions of feeling. They're expressions, but they don't explain. And so, a clear example, I would say, on this would be the mentality that still would want to read the first couple of chapters of Genesis as an explanation of how the world came into being. Right? It's a story. It's a story that conveys a powerful religious message, but it doesn't say how it happened. It doesn't. There's no explanatory power in that sense there. It's a symbolic expression of it. Does reflect that God created the world, and it expresses some beautiful things about this creator God. And those things are true, but the story itself is not how it happened. And anyone who wants to hold on to it as this is how it happened is giving explanatory power to something that never intended to happen. Second, the real is not known only through an integrated and intense flow of sensitive representations, feelings, words, and actions. The real is known only in the impalpable act of rational descent, of a judgment based on the reflective grasp of sufficient evidence. That's a hard thing for us to get a hold of, because sometimes that's not the most exciting operation we perform, grasping the sufficiency of the evidence and saying yes. That's when the real is known, when we assent to evidence that has been grasped as sufficient for medicine. But nowhere else do we know what is. We think about, we move towards, we feel, and so on, but to say yes is when we know what is. To say yes on the basis of evidence. Thirdly, however, and here I'm referring to a correspondence between some of the things that Lonergan says and Paul Ricoeur. The symbol gives rise to thought. Ricoeur's famous phrase that has been repeated over and over again from the symbolism of evil. There's a correspondence on the psychic level to the known unknown on the intellectual and spiritual levels. And so the symbol gives rise to reflection and causes us to raise questions. The symbol can be brought into fuller consciousness. It can be interpreted. The interpretation can be judged to be more or less accurate. The symbol can be a way to internal communication in the subject between the mind and the spirit on the one hand and the psyche and the body on the other hand. Dream symbols can help people with that internal communication. the dictates and aspirations of the pure desire can be embodied in the symbol in ways that release creativity and fruitful activity. In all of this, and this would be the way the later Larner would put it, the criterion is self-transcendence. This is how you adjudicate between the symbolic expressions of positions and the symbolic expressions of counterpositions. What carries you to self-transcendence, to transcend yourself to the true, to the good, to love, to beauty? That's what is to be gone with. It's a negation kind of discernment. What carries you to self-transcendence? The dictates and aspirations, pardon me, the criterion of self-transcendence, where self-transcendence is set by the spiritual operator, which invite the psychic operator along so that our feelings can be every bit as much self-transcendent as our questions for intelligence, reflection, and deliberation. And in fact, if they're not self-transcendent, if our feelings are still self-enclosed, then they will put an inhibition. There will be an inhibition placed by the psyche on the spiritual operators themselves. Now, it may be that it's therapy to get at the feelings so that they can open out into self-transcendence towards truth and the good and love and so on. But that's the sort of attempt that he's taking here. A couple of times in both writing and in lectures, I've expressed how this actually, I don't think this is, when I was writing my thesis in Zurich, and really struggling with how do you put what Lonergan is talking about into any kind of dialogue with the depth psychological thing and with Jung and all that sort of thing. There was a dream that I had where I was going down into the basement, and the basement was very much the basement of the Jesuit house that I was living in Zurich, Orientiro, one of the sides of the Lake of Zurich, I forget whether it's the east or the west side. But anyway, going down into the basement, walking down the steps in the basement, and who do I meet coming up the steps? But Bernard Lonergan, he's walking up the steps. And he looks at me, and probably none of you have ever seen this, but you didn't know him personally, but he was really onto something. He got a gleam in his eye and a sparkle in his smile, and he gave me that face, and he said, if you really want to see some images, come with me. So he takes me up the stairs, not down. You can't negotiate it down there. You've got to bring the images up, okay, through waking experience, remember them, interpret them. That's understanding. Make your interpretation as accurate as possible. Make your decisions on the basis of that. So he takes me up, and up to the top floor of the house, and there actually were, with the basement, four floors in the house. So we're talking about four levels. I mean, I don't know how literal you want to make all of this. But then we sit and we watch the images on a movie screen, where there is also a certain kind of aesthetic kind of distance that enables you not to be so totally wrapped up in them that you can't adjudicate them in some kind of interpretive skill and so on and so forth. I didn't use that so much as a key to unraveling the mystery, but I realized afterwards that was exactly what was happening in terms of the way I was attempting, or finally coming to see the relationship between these two dimensions of interiority. The symbolic, the symbol is the neural coming into the consciousness through psychic representation. But that's only the beginning of the consciousness, and then the symbol must be interpreted. Dream symbols are to be interpreted. And the interpretation has to be as accurate as possible. There's a whole set of criteria for the interpretation of dreams. The interpretation has to feel the way the dream felt, for instance. It must feel the same way the dream felt, or it's not accurate. And so on. And then in some instances, these dreams are to be acted on. And that's the level of decision. At any rate, that's the kind of thing that he's getting at here. That there's a correspondence between the psychic and the intentional. The symbol gives rise to thought and recurs expression. And both of those dimensions are permanent in the structure of the human subject. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about what we took last week. Sum it up, because we got into a lot of different things, and I think there's a for other expressions like the criteria of software and so on. That might be more helpful than mystery and myth, for instance, in particular. Are there any questions, objections, discuss before we take the next step?
Just a quick question. When you say you're spiritual operators, you mean the falling in love?
I mean a number of things. The questions. So, and he uses the term intellectual operator here, but there's a whole set of operators, and I think intellectual may be a little too narrow for embracing the entire set. So that's why I said intellectual operators, or if you want, spiritual operators, because in the full Lonergan position, which is what he came to later after this, he's not concerned only with cognition theory. He's concerned with intentionality analysis, which includes a fourth level, which is not knowledge, but decision. He's concerned with love as well. So the operators at the spiritual level would be questions for intelligence. That's operating you from experience to understanding. You go from the first to the second level of consciousness because this question operates that movement. Okay. Questions for reflection. Is it so? Operates you from the second level to the third level. So it's an operator of moving to a third level. Questions for deliberation. Operates you from the whole of knowledge to decision, fourth level. Falling in love and being in the dynamic state of being in love is the operator that keeps all of these consistently on the move. Okay, so one becomes consistently, and his later work, Lonergan says, one becomes consistently self-transcendent to the extent that one has fallen in love and is in the habitual state of being. There is a habitual state of being in love which enables self-transcendence to everything. Okay, now the psychic operator that's in correspondence with these operators. In Insight, it's talked about as some cosmic dimension in our feelings. Okay? So it's that the sense of openness, of awe before it all, okay? Before everything that we're open to, there's a sense of that as well as an intellectual and deliberative anticipation of it. There's also a sense of it. And that operates psychological development. That keeping that sense alive, okay, is the operator of. Now, he'll move this more into this structure in his later work, and he'll talk about the symbolic operator that operates the movement from the neural into consciousness in the first place, like, for instance, through dreams. In our dream symbols, the symbols are operating a movement out of unconsciousness into consciousness. It's the rudimentary form of consciousness. And then he'll say the psychic operator cuts through all of this because it's, as a symbolic operator, it moves us from the neural to consciousness, but as feeling, it permeates all of these operations and gives them their mass and momentum, without which they would be paper thin. And it changes, but it sometimes can help operate these changes as well because you can feel that there's something wrong. You know, and you have a feeling that, you know, I don't get this yet, I'm confused. And that can be, for some people, that is more at the affective level than at the intellectual level. But it's moving, it's forcing the question that will move them to clarification and so on. And then so it cuts through all of these as an affective operator, and then at the level of love, it's what he'll call the intersubjective operator. That moves you to community with the three divine persons and with your fellow men and women. into intersubjectivity. Yes, Cheryl.
I have a question here and on your sheet. The symbol can be brought into fuller consciousness. It can be interpreted, and the interpretation can be judged to be more or less accurate. I have a question about the word, the use of accurate there. Adequate is the word that he uses, this Lorien uses, and I think that I can buy into that.
Mm-hmm. He uses adequate for expression.
Right.
Okay.
And valid is a word that Ricoeur uses, and B. Hirsch uses in a much stricter way. But accurate has me. A scientific reading of Genesis,
okay,
or to read Genesis as scientific fact, is certainly, I think, inadequate and inaccurate. But how do you read a work of art or a book?
I'm thinking here more of the dream symbol, because that's the kind of thing that I've worked with more than anything else.
Okay.
But I think that if I'm working with, let's say, some kind of powerful dream, and I bring it to a psychologist or an analyst or whatever, and they try to give me an interpretation of it, and I may or may not know that they're on target for that. So adequate, but I want to go a little further, at least with those, because I mean, we're talking here. It's very important to me, or it would be to you, because how you interpret that dream has an awful lot to do about what you're going to do with your life, and it's your self-constitution, and you want that to be built on something that you can really give assent to. I think there are criteria for grasping the virtually unconditioned with regard to the meaning of dream symbols, and I think that some of those criteria can be worked out in these formulations along these lines, and I've started to do a little bit of that with the stuff on psychic conversion. I don't, by no means have I done it completely or anything like that, but I, you know, how do you adjudicate the difference between Jung and Freud on the interpretation of dreams? I mean, basically, I'm going to have to say not only is one fundamentally more adequate, but more closer to the truth, I would have to say closer to the truth, in terms of what dreams can be and what they can be. And then I would want to go a step beyond. I mean, I have to say that Jung is more satisfactory than Freud, because I don't think all dreams can be reduced to the displacement of sexual energy. I just think that's a fundamentally erroneous position. And Jung doesn't hold that. But I think that there's a whole dimension that this can bring into the play that can move Jung a step further with regard to the ultimate. It's a question of where our finality is heading.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
Yeah.
So you do think that there is a single truthful interpretation of the dream, there's an accurate interpretation?
Completely, no, I don't. I don't think so, because an archetypal or anagogic dream is going to be so invested with mystery that we'll never be able to articulate its meaning completely. But I think you can know when you're on track and when you're off track with it. And that's all I mean by it. If you would rather substitute adequate there, that's fine for me. But I also want to say that I can tell, I would want to be able to tell somebody who's trying to tell me the meaning of my dream, I don't think you're right. You know, at that point, I want to say that it's inaccurate. If they wanted to give us an exclusively Freudian or reductive interpretation of a religious dream, for instance, it doesn't hold. It just doesn't. And in that sense, it's wrong. So I want to let go at least that far. Ricoeur, what is Ricoeur's term? Valid?
Well, there's a big argument in literary theory about validity.
Yeah.
Is there a valid interpretation of a story or a dream? E.D. Hirsch uses it in a very strict term. There is a correct reading. That's what he means by valid. Ricoeur uses valid, but in more sort of in Lorien sense, an adequacy, I think, is the main thing.
These are big issues in our world. Is a true interpretation at all possible? Or do you know when you are at least approaching true interpretation of another expression? That's the question that he's dealing with here.
Right.
And I think he would say, Maharingan will say that in the last analysis, almost all interpretation is hypothetical. But at the same time, you do have a sense that some hypotheses are better than others, and they're closer to the truth.
I would tend to agree with that, but you know, certainly in the postmodern world, that's not necessarily the case.
You know what you mentioned last week about the, that most most understanding is misunderstanding?
All reading is misreading, or all interpretation is misinterpretation.
Yeah. Right? Well, you know, that's not that far from insights are a dime a dozen, you know, which is Lonergan's offhand expression of saying a lot of our insights are wrong. You know. But then he wants to go, the problem is figuring out which ones are right. And he does maintain that some of them are right, and that sometimes we can know that. So, but I don't think he's that far from the pessimism about a lot of them being wrong. That position. Okay. All right, let's move to, I want to take a couple of things from last week with regard to the question of truth. And that's why he, in this, rather than, self-transcendence, he's saying here that the way of expressing this criterion of self-transcendence at this time is to say that the key issue is truth. Well, it's one of the key issues. If you're working within an exclusively cognitive and intellectual framework, that's the way you put it. But later on, the issue is self-transcendence. With regard to truth, or in the words of Pontius Pilate, as I say, I don't know, it's here, what is truth? Well, I'm just going to take two things, number 12 and number 15, from the notes from last class. Regarding the criterion of truth, Lonergan will distinguish between the proximate and the remote criterion. The proximate criterion of the truth is the reflective grasp of the condition, which yields an absolute objectivity that establishes a public or common terrain through which different subjects can and do communicate and agree. So the reflective grasp of the virtually unconditioned, that all relevant questions have been answered on a given issue, that yields a yes that has a certain absolute, that has an absoluteness to it, and that absoluteness makes the truth public. It's not just the truth for me. It has a public, common domain. It's in the public domain. The remote criterion, which is necessitated by the inevitable context of other acts and other contents, the remote criterion is the unfolding in our lives of the pure, detached, and disinterested desire to know, or of the pure desire in general. If you want to put it in the framework, the full framework of self-transcendence, that's the proper unfolding of that. Negatively, this means the absence of interference from other desires. I don't allow my hopes or my fears to influence my judgment of truth. The positive discussion means distinguishing a number of different things, and I'm not going to go into all of those distinctions, infallibility, certainty, probability, and so on. We can take that in the form of questions if we have time. I want to move into the interpretation. But I just want to state then his definition of truth, which is given here in number 15. It's a rehabilitation of the Thomist notion of truth. If knowing is true by its relation to being, then truth is either the identity of knower and known, as in God, or the correspondence of my affirmations and negations to what is and is not. My affirmations to what is, the correspondence of my affirmations to what is, the correspondence of my negations to what is not. Okay. So that, I just want to take those two things out of that discussion. Unless we have other questions about that section, I'd like to move on into the truth of interpretation. Are we ready to do that? What then is truth in interpretation? Is it possible? How is it determined? What are its criteria? How does the historical sense avoid individual, group, and general bias? How does it avoid relativism? The basic problem of interpretation is put both simply and in a more complex fashion on pages 585 to 587. Simply put, it's the following. The problem is this. While any simple interpretation may be correct, While it might hit off for a contemporary audience the principal insight communicated by the original document, while the interpreter may know the interpretation is correct, still the historical sense and the interpretive sense is open to individual, group, and general bias, and dramatic bias as well, and also is not capable of assigning exact and convincing reasons for its verdict. But if interpretation is to be scientific, so what he's saying there is that you may read a philosophic text, or again, you may preach on a scriptural text, and your interpretation in either case may be right. You may be communicating to a contemporary audience what the document itself is conveying. But it's another question to ask you to assign reasons for your knowing that you've got it right. How do you adjudicate that? And that's what he means by a scientific interpretation. It's to push to the level of attempting to present reasons for it. And how do you know that you're free in your interpretation from individual, group, general, and dramatic bias? So if interpretation is to be scientific, then the grounds for the interpretation have to be assignable. If interpretation is to be scientific, there will not be a range of different interpretations due to the different biases, individual, group, and general bias of the historical sense of different experts. If interpretation is to be scientific, then it has to discover some method of conceiving and determining the habitual development of all audiences, and it has to invent some technique by which its expression escapes relativity to particular and incidental audiences. Now, there will be an entire postmodern stream which will say that that's impossible. But he is attempting to cut a way through that so that there is a way in which it can be held that there is a validity to interpretation that does escape that ultimate relativism. No matter how hypothetical the interpretation may be, we, just as with anything else, we do have a way of knowing when we're getting closer to. In some instances, when we have actually reached it. There's one thing that. Oh, yeah. In the terminology of method and theology, I just thought of this as I was just reading this right here. There would be a way of knowing whether one's interpretation is complementary to someone else's interpretation or genetically related to someone else's interpretation, or dialectically related to someone else's interpretation. There are the three relationships. There's an ultimate perspectivism, which Lonergan acknowledges quite clearly in the chapter on history in Method and Theology, which means that any one of us is going to be reading other texts from his or her own perspective. But that does not mean an ultimate relativism. Perspectivism is not the same as relativism. And it's through this structure here that he's attempting to enable us to determine when our perspectival readings are complementary, when they can be perhaps genetically related to one another, and when they are dialectically related to one another. And dialectical, in this sense, for Lonergan means one. If one interpretation is the case, the opposite cannot be equally the case. So this is the way that he'll put the same point later on, that there is a way of adjudicating whether or not different readings are complementary, whether they're related genetically, or whether their relationship to one another is dialectical. So the difference then, note the difference, for those of you who want to pursue this question on insight and method and theology, number two here, the difference between the hermeneutic and historical theory offered here and the positions on interpretation and history presented in method and theology. Now what I've got here in number two is different from what I just said here. Contradictory to it, it's just another point. In insight, Lonergan more or less takes it for granted that scholars, by long familiarity with the documents and monuments of another age, and by an increasing accumulation of complementary insights as they study that age,
can arrive at a participation of the common sense of another period, and can know by a kind of learned second nature how the men and women of that time would or would not speak and act, and what they would do in certain types of situations. So he's more or less taking that for granted in Insight, that by long familiarity with the documents and monuments of another age, if you're a scholar of the New Testament times, for instance, or of Jerusalem in New Testament times, whatever, by long familiarity with everything that has become available about that, we can arrive at a participation in the mentality of the people of that time and that period and that place, and have a general sense of how people would respond, speaking and acting and doing in certain types of situations. He's taking that for granted in Insight, and the emphasis in Insight is on the scientific interpretation, on assigning a method that would enable an account that explains how and to what extent an interpretation escapes relativity, complete relativity to time and place. In Method and Theology, the emphasis is just the reverse. In the chapters on interpretation and history, he's concerned with the dynamics of how do you get to participate in the common sense of another time? What is it? What do you have to go through to get to the point where you've got this familiarity that enables you to make reasonable judgments on what people meant in first century Jerusalem, first century BC Jerusalem. Jerusalem. So in the chapters, he's concerned, with the dynamics of grasping or approaching the virtually unconditioned in these functional specialties of interpretation of history. He's not concerned in Method so much with the more transcendental considerations that are offered in Insight. Not when he's discussing interpretation of history. It's when he moves, this material here comes up at the end of the chapter on history, the material on perspectivism. But it's only in the chapter on dialectic that he'll move to these transcendental considerations. But he has much fuller explanations of the steps of exegesis and of critical historical work and Method that he has here. My own view is that both of these emphases are necessary, and I think I added this morning when I read these again, that I think both of these emphases are reflected, for instance, in the contemporary critical realist approach to biblical exegesis. And let me just mention some names here of people that there's a slow movement that I think is beginning in biblical exegesis that's very much informed by these two books, by Insight and Method and Theology. Sean McKevenue in Old Testament Work, Ben Meyer, recently deceased, in the New Testament, The Aims of Jesus, N.T. Wright, done three volumes so far of a massive five-volume work on the New Testament, and James Dunn. Wright and Dunn, picking up from Meyer, Meyer very much reliant directly on Lorimer. But there's a movement now in scriptural studies where I think the combination of the two approaches from Insight and Method are put together in the reading of the New Testament by these people and probably others. It was very interesting, and when we set up a booth at the American Academy of Religion last year, the number of biblical scholars that came by in stock, and that's because they had been influenced by the work of Ben Meyer, but they were interested. They knew the name Lauterman from Meyer's work, The Aims of Jesus in particular, on New Testament Christology. Okay, so number three then, the key to scientific interpretation, what he means by scientific interpretation here, lies in two areas. Number one, the notion of a universal viewpoint. And number two, the levels and sequences of expression. By universal viewpoint, that's what he means. The universal viewpoint is the method of conceiving and determining the habitual development of all audiences. It's the technique by which expression can escape relativity to particular and incidental audiences. And as we saw last week, it's the universal viewpoint is a potential totality of genetically and dialectically ordered viewpoints. His point is that we're already in possession of that to the extent that we have appropriated this structure. To the extent that we've appropriated this structure, we are in possession of a potential totality of ordered, genetically and dialectically ordered viewpoints. A universal viewpoint is not universal history, as in Hegel, for instance. It's not a Hegelian dialectic that's complete apart from matters of fact. It's not a Kantian a priori that is complete, that is determinate and merely awaits imposition upon the raw materials of vicarious experience. It is simply a heuristic structure that every expression of the human being, of human subjects, is going to somehow involve elements from this structure. And so the more we are familiar with this structure and what is possible within this structure, the better basis we have for comprehending what someone else is expressing. A heuristic structure that contains virtually all the various ranges of possible alternatives of interpretation. It can list its own contents only through the stimulus of documents and historical inquiry. So it's not a matter of an a priori or of knowledge without any experience of reading the documents. It can select between the alternatives and differentiate its generalities only by appealing to the accepted norms of historical investigation. And so there's all this, the hard slug work of exegesis and history that has to go on. But from what standpoint? From what standpoint are the operations of exegetical and historical work carried on? What he's saying is that to the extent that you have appropriated this structure, it gives you a much better chance of really understanding what another person might be trying to say. So it's potential. That's the first point. It's a potential. It's the same thing as that by being a person who can proceed from experience to understanding to judgment, that's what enables you to have common sense. That's what enables you to learn mathematics. That's what enables you to learn natural science. Now he's saying that's what enables you to understand what other people are doing. He's not making any further claim than that. The more you're in possession of this, the better chance you have of understanding where they're coming from. Secondly, it's a totality of viewpoints. And a viewpoint is a habitual accumulation of insight. So it's a totality of viewpoints. Its concern is with meaning, not with expression. Expression will come up in a second criterion for the upper blade of a hermeneutics. But here it's meaning and the levels of meaning, and especially the principal acts of meaning that lie in the insights and the judgments of other people. So that's what it's concerned about. Focus on expression will be found in such disciplines as phonetics, comparative grammar, lexicography, linguistic and stylistic analysis, and also later in Lonergan's own thing on the levels and sequences of expression. And these are not unimportant, but the universal viewpoint is not a matter of being able to figure out comparative grammar, right lexicons and dictionaries and that sort of thing. How does it reach the principal acts of meaning? How does it reach the insights and the judgments of others? I'd like to invite you here to consider the model of conversation. So if you're having a conversation with another person, and you're trying to understand the insights and the judgments of that other person, you are going to direct attention not only to the sounds that the other person is emitting by speaking to you, but you're going to be directing attention to your own insights and judgments. And you're going to be saying, now, do you mean this? Do you mean that? And the only way that you're going to get to the insights of another person is by going through your own. Okay? Do I understand you correctly? That's the kind of thing that he's talking about here in reading texts, is that you direct attention. There's a model of conversation that's involved in the reading of text. There is, if you want, Gadamer's expression, the fusion of horizons in reading the text. And it's a fusion of horizons. You've got to be aware of where you're coming from and what your own insights and what your own prejudgments are, and enable them to come into conversation with the expression, the expressed insights and the expressed judgments of other people. So how do I reach what you're trying to say? If you write something, or you write a paper and you give it to me, by directing attention not to the external sources, to spatially ordered marks on paper or parchment. Of course, I've got to read that. Okay. But I must reflect upon my own experience, understanding, and critical reflection with regard to precisely what it is that you're attempting to communicate to me, and bring my insights and my judgments into dialogue with what it is that you are saying. And I may have to raise questions to you. Is this what you mean? Do I understand you correctly? But the ultimate sources of interpretation are not on this page. The ultimate sources of interpretation are in you. They're in you. They're imminent in the interpreter. In your own ability to work backwards from your experience to the experience of another age, for instance, through imaginative excursions or whatever, earlier accumulations of insights, in your ability to envisage the protean possibilities of this structure, the structure which is a notion of being and a notion of God, what it is capable of and how it is capable of going astray, of distortion. In your own ability to look at the quote from page 590, I'm just jumping a couple of pages here. In the measure that one grasps the structure of this protean notion of being, and let's make it the full notion, protean notion of being and of the good and of world transcendence and everything else, the whole thing that's contended by experiencing, understanding, judgment, decision, love. In the measure that one grasps that structure with familiarity, concrete familiarity, not just as an abstract heuristic structure, but exploring the different levels, one possesses the base and the ground from which one can proceed in the contact and context of every other meaning, of every meaning. In the measure that one explores human experience, human insights, human reflection, human polymorphic consciousness, one becomes capable, when provided with the appropriate data, capable of approximating to the content and the context of the meaning of any given expression. That's the claim. We have any questions, first of all, for understanding?
I'm not sure whether this is for understanding. It's striking me as being very similar to the claim of therapists when they're doing psychotherapy, that what they're doing is going through their own counter-transference. Is it similar or not similar? So the whole notion of transference and counter-transference, and then counter-transference in a way you are interpreting the transference.
I don't know whether it is or not. I'm not sure. I had never thought of that. But I don't know whether those dynamics would be necessarily operative. Where do you see the similarity with transference?
In the sense that it boils down to objectivity being authentic subjectivity. So when you are interpreting a text, you have to be attentive to your own experiencing, understanding, and judgment, and whatnot. And this is where I see the parallel. That in a way, when you are interpreting what your client is bringing to the conversation, you have to be attentive to your own.
That's right. And it is only through your own experience and understanding and judgment and decision and values that you are going to understand. Going to go through that. It must. And just as in, I prefer rather than the therapeutic model, I would prefer the conversational model as a way of, but the only way that I can understand what you're saying right now is to ask you whether or not I've got it right. You know, and in that sense, I'm going through my own experience and my own insights and my own judgments to try to understand what it is that you are, that you've got a hold of. That you're trying to express to me. It's through that. So that the imminent sources of my interpretation of what you're saying are not simply the sounds in the air. That's out there. But it's my filtering the message, that the meaning that you are expressing to me through my experience, understanding, and judgment, and asking the questions of whether I've got you right or not.
And only then am I going to understand, or am I going to approximate an understanding of what it is that you're expressing. So too, he would say, with the reading of a text, and the more familiarity that I have, not only with the time and place in which the text was written, but with the possibilities of this structure in general, then the more equipment I've got through which to filter what it is that I'm reading and that someone else has written.
So you think that there might be a similarity or not?
I hadn't thought of the transference counter-transference dynamic as part of it. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll have to think about that. There is a similarity with conversation, that much I know. But is that therapeutic dynamic operative in all conversation, or is it operative in all interpretation? I'm not sure what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to go that far. Mm-hmm. Are there any further questions? Cora?
More a comment that hearing you describe what goes on as a conversation model, for me, really affirms and emphasizes the intersubjective dynamic without saying or naming it specifically as in the context of love, but that in that intersubjective dynamic, that there will be new questions, new experience, new understanding, and it isn't any longer the partner A or partner B in the conversation, because it's so much the shared dynamic. And so I'd always thought of the intersubjective certainly as there, but in spelling it out, that seems to me a place where it's spelled out very specifically.
In some of his later work, the dialogue model is made explicit, you know, and I think it's been implicit all along, that everyone who engages in the interpretation of another human being's utterances, everyone who engages, is, in fact, this structure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it is some variant on the structure of experiencing, understanding, judging, deciding, what. So the more that people reveal to one another their experiences, their insights, their judgments, their decisions. It's through that mutual self-mediation that occurs in that kind of conversation that they come to understand each other. And so that there's something analogous that takes place in reading the text of someone else that you're not face-to-face with, but you are engaging that other person through the structure out of which that text was written, which is this structure. And so to the extent that you are familiar with the structure itself, you have a much better chance of understanding and perhaps raising questions about what the other person is saying. That's all he's doing. But this helps in human mutual understanding. This has a contribution to make. There's no way he's intending here to be presenting a full hermeneutic theory. I mean, he was very clear on that. I've never done a full hermeneutics. He says, I've offered some things that I think would belong in a complete hermeneutic theory. That's all. And his main point in this section is, to the extent that you know this structure, you have a better chance of understanding what comes from the same structure in another person.
And a notion, is it Augustinian, of a sin in a theological context? And there's lots more to be explored, but it's that dynamic that goes beyond oneself, from oneself, beyond oneself, rather to turn back on oneself and to stay locked in oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an understanding of sinfulness, but possibly even the notion of alienation.
You mean for the breakdown of communication?
The breakdown of communication, where it's not self-reflection and self-appropriation.
Or self-transcendence.
Or self-transcendence.
Okay. So the claim that he's making up to this point is that he'll everything else that comes after this, I think, is an unfolding of this claim, that the more, the quote from 590 again, in the measure that one grasps the structure,
of this protea notion of being, one possesses the base and ground from which one can proceed to the content and context of every meaning, because every meaning comes from this structure as it is embodied in him and her, and so on. In the measure that one explores human experience, human understanding, human reflection, human polymorphic consciousness, one becomes capable, to that extent, when provided with the appropriate data, of approximating the content and context of the meaning of any given expression. So it's a potential totality. The universal viewpoint is a potential totality. It's a totality of viewpoints. Thirdly, it's an ordered totality, and its order is both genetic and dialectical. So if you're in possession of this as a universal viewpoint, right, you've got an ordered totality that enables you to understand how one expression can come out of another one. And this is particularly relevant with the philosophic issues that he's attempting to discuss and to interpret here. The universal viewpoint has its base in an adequate self-knowledge and in the consequent metaphysics. It has a retrospective expansion in the various genetic series of discoveries through which we could advance to our present knowledge. And I'm putting in here the example that has appeared in a couple of Fred Crow's writings, which is a major sweep on the differentiation of consciousness in Western philosophy. But just to show you, I mean, it shows you this in very broad outlines, that with Plato and Aristotle, we have a differentiation of experience from understanding from experience, the first two levels of this structure. With Thomas Aquinas, we have a differentiation of judgment from understanding. With Kierkegaard, and you could add here with Newman, and this would be the one that would be more influential on Lonergan himself, we have a differentiation of decision of knowledge. So, and that's a sense in which you get a retrospective look at the genetic series of discoveries through which we've come to our present understanding. But you've got a differentiation. All along the line, people have been exercising experience, understanding, judgment, and decision. It's a question of differentiating. In Plato, and then more clearly yet in Aristotle, you have understanding differentiated from experience. In Thomas, judgment from understanding. In Kierkegaard and Newton, decision from knowledge. So that's on a very broad sweep of the type of thing that he's talking about here. It has a dialectical expansion in the many discoveries due to polymorphic consciousness, in the invitation issued by positions to further development, and in the implication and counterpositions of narrow reversal. Finally, it can reach a concrete presentation of any form of any discovery through the identification in personal experience of the elements that, as confused or as distinguished and related, as related under this or that orientation of polymorphic consciousness, could combine to make the position or counterposition humanly convincing. That's a quote from 589, but the example that I put in here is, look at how we try to locate, through identification in personal experience, what it is that Lonergan's talking about. Well, that's what he's saying you do when you're reading any philosophic text, is that you're trying to reach, through the identification in personal experience, what the elements are that this person is talking about. And all he's saying is that the more you're familiar with the details of this structure, the better chance you've got. Or again, compare the various dynamics of the conversation, and particularly a conversation on issues about philosophical or theological questions. Okay? I want to identify in personal experience what it is you're talking about. That's the first thing that I've got to do. Otherwise, I can't go any further. And so I want to locate those elements in myself, in this structure, as I'm living this structure. And maybe you're calling me to a conversion. Then I've got to find out what the elements are in me that are resisting that conversion. It's a simple matter of saying that the more you've got this, the differentiation on this, and the more you realize that it's ever precarious in its authenticity, the better chance you've got of understanding what someone else is saying. But even this ordering of viewpoints is potential in the universal viewpoint. It's just that you're just in potency to understanding how different viewpoints can be ordered to one another. what is ordered, the history of philosophy, for instance, becomes more specific, more differentiated, more precise, more under the monitoring of an explicit method as one's own development goes forward and as history reaches some degree of cultural advance. The developments are nuanced, and they've got to be nuanced. The dialectical oppositions are not simply the clear-cut identifications of the real, either with being or with the already out there now. That's an oversimplification of the issues. It helps to get the point across, but it's not like, you know, the people who want to take Lonergan and read everybody and say, well, naive realist, idealist, etc. No, it's not that simple, okay? It's not just the objective, either with the intelligent and reasonable or with elementary extroversion. Most of us are a combination of those things, okay? It's not just identifying knowledge either with inquiry and critical reflection or with taking a good look. These extremes tend to merge in all of us in the ambivalence of the aesthetic, the dramatic, and the practical patterns of experience. And that's going to show in our writings as well, to give rise to questions that not only are unsolved, but also inadequately conceived, to make their clearest appearance not in the field of knowledge, but rather in the volitional tension between moral aspiration and practical living. But again, there you've got a whole other dimension that we'll begin to see next week. And by the way, with next week, I want you to read chapter 18, but I'm also going to bring in the dynamics from chapter 2 of Ethic and Theology, which is another approach to the question of the good and ethics. I think they're complementary to each other, but they are quite distinct. All right, so I think we should break for a bit, but let's just see if we get any questions about this material before we break. Or any challenges to it? Chris?
Just a question relating more towards your earlier comments about truth and things that we picked up from last week.
Mm-hmm.
It pertains to this reading, though, but my question is basically, he talks about Gödel's theorem,
mm-hmm.
and he contrasts, you know, the treatise, mathematical treatise, and the electronic computer, and they have these kind of recurrent themes versus system on the move and the dynamism of consciousness. And I'm wondering about the distinction between the virtually, he makes a distinction at one point, the virtually unconditioned and the formally unconditioned, and the way of intermediate certainties along the way, or do you know what I'm talking about? And I'm just wondering about having, that you can't fit all of mathematics into a single treatise, but he's saying, at least my interpretation, I'm asking for clarification, that with generalized empirical method, you have all of philosophy, at least, and a heuristic anticipation of anything that can be said in this book, there it is, like, in one treatise.
No, not in this book.
No. Mm-hmm. Okay. In me, okay, yes. Well, I like that. Thank you.
It's not in this book. It's not in this book. It isn't.
That's nice.
It's in you.
So let me ask then, some of the...
You are the ultimate,
yes,
upper context, not
the... I love it. So then my question is what's the difference then between...
You too.
Oh, me too, Tom. My question then is, like, with the virtually unconditioned, we can never rule out the emergence of further emergence of further questions. Yeah?
Well, there's a dotter tertium here, I think, you know. It's,
a what?
There's a third possibility, that the excluded middle, or whatever. If it's really the virtually unconditioned, if you've really grasped that there are no further questions and that there can't be any further questions on a given issue, then the answer is no. How often do you grasp that is another question. Okay.
Like you were saying that all interpretations, you would say, in your mind, Lonergan would say, they're all probably highly probable at best.
He says that from the very beginning of his work, and when he did the business on Aquinas. You know, he does say that most... I'll get the exact quote on this, but that most interpretation is hypothetical, but that What we do know is that we're getting closer to them. Interpretation. But so do you ever, or does the historian, how often does the historian grasp the virtually unconditioned? Well, it's probably the case that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, all right, and that nobody's, it's quite unlikely that they would say that, you know, that never really happened or whatever.
Yeah.
But what the meaning of that might be, okay, is subject to ever further development.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain, in the chapter on history, I haven't read it for a while, so I'm speaking here from a couple of years ago at least. In the chapter on history and method and theology, there are certain contexts that are probably fairly well closed. But at some times, not because there might not be further relevant questions, but because nobody's really interested in raising them. I mean, who cares how old Nero was when he died? You know,
yes.
And if somebody wants to go back and do that, that's fine. But there's a lot more important things to devote your attention to than that. So you regard some things as closed, either because there's no further interest, or because maybe all that's really important has been dealt with. And so he says, in quick shorthand, Nero will always be Nero, but you can't say the same thing about Luther or Kierkegaard or Schleiermacher or whatever. Like the meanings of certain lives are continually going to unfold.
So there are some things that no matter what evidence is uncovered in the future, we can say, like, we know these things now, like,
I think that,
beyond
I
all
think
doubt.
That's probably the case. You know, I would say that.
Okay.
And then certainly in the field of ordinary common sense, I mean, it's you can grasp with sufficient evidence that you and I are speaking to each other right now.
Mm.
There's nobody really wants to seriously call that into question. You know, I hope.
What I'm getting to is just the, you know, it depends for him. This depends on the self-affirmation of the knower and the isomorphism with.
But he also will maintain that self-affirmation as a philosophic judgment is not subject to radical revision.
That's what I'm getting at.
I know that's what you're getting.
Yeah.
and he does maintain that. You'll fill it out.
Yes.
You'll add to it.
Yes, but that's...
He added to it. He added three more levels before he died, and he had them going up and down before he died. Here he's all he's got to do. That's it.
Yes.
But he's got, you know, one at the bottom and two more at the top, and they're going this way.
But that's a big do.
That's a big, and you won't go back on that. That's all.
You won't go back on
that. The basic structure is not subject to fundamental. But you can add all kinds of things to it. You can, the more we figure out about the imagination, for instance, well, we put a lot more in there. That, you know, how the imagination filters, works through that whole structure, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic operations, experiencing and then understanding and then judging, that.
So would that do be the the closest kind of certainty and this intermediary of certainties between the virtually unconditioned and the formally unconditioned?
No, he would say that's a virtually unconditioned. The virtually unconditioned that I am a unity identity whole whose consciousness unfolds on at least the three levels of experiencing, understanding, and judging.
Uh-huh.
There's sufficient evidence for me to affirm that.
Done.
What
about, but what's this intermediary then? Because I thought that was a kind
the
of
intermediary, as I've got to go back and look at it again, but I think it's the kinds of judgments that we make when we know we're getting closer and closer to the truth. And sometimes you know you're getting closer to it, but you know you're not quite there yet. And we have a sense for that, you know, because the questions are drying up, the flow of relevant questions, and yet there are still a few more. That we've got more to do. It's like it might be. I'd have to look at that section again. But
even on your explanation right there, then you can say that the self-affirmation of the knower for someone who's affirmed themselves could be one of those very like, but you just know it. Like
that's right.
If it's a spectrum of like, I think I'm there, but not really there. But that would be one that you really know, or at least can really know.
Yeah. And he would say that even that there's even a virtually unconditioned in a probable judgment, because it is virtually unconditioned that this is probably true.
Probable as probable.
Yeah, probable as you grasp the probable as probable.
Yeah.
So.
things.
But that's, yeah, okay. And that is the upper context that for Gödel's theorem, for instance, within mathematics, every mathematical system will be gone beyond.
Because it's still those classical laws there.
Because there will be questions that will arise within the system that the system can't answer.
Is that in terms of classical?
It's more in terms of mathematics. Lonergan will say the same thing about systematic theology in Deontological, that every theological system will eventually give rise to questions that the system can't answer. But what is the source of the questions and the answers? Experiencing, understanding, judging. Mm. But he'll say that he'll apply Gödel's theorem to the systematic theology. He'll just do it like that. The sum of questions at a certain in a given system in theology, the sum of the answers is equal to the sum of the questions. But out of this, there will come some question where the sum of the questions is going to be greater than the available responses. That's when theology moves on further.
Not to belabor this, but then would classical laws, statistical probabilities, and the genetic link between them count as a system that could be moved beyond?
Yeah, probably.
It would be.
Well, scientific ideals have moved beyond. You know?
Well, because that seems like at the basis of the do-do-do.
basis of that.
Okay, but like that's the.
Well, certainly.
That's the correlative in the universe.
I'm not a scientist, so I don't know for this for sure. But
I can barely ask.
Scientific ideals have been transformed from the state of Aristotle's true and certain knowledge of things and their causal necessity. To the probable grasp, or the best available scientific opinion, hypothetical laws, to states and probabilities, and you know there may be something further. When Stephen Hawking says that they're still looking for the unified field theory, you know he means that they're not there yet, and so who knows what further transformations there are going to be before we get there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be experiencing, understanding, and judging that does it.
Uh-huh.
So the structure is consistent. Let's break 10 or so.